Today's episode of the Occasional Podcast is sponsored by Atocha Design. Atocha Design of New York handcrafts heirloom quality furniture for storing records and audio components right here in the U.S. From cocktail tables to their series of record cabinets, Atocha Design makes high-end furniture that not only allows for quick access to your vinyl collection, but does so in a way that is both beautiful and functional. Each handcrafted piece was designed and constructed with careful consideration to specifically accommodate the heavy weight of an LP collection. Every item is made to order and can be customized with a range of wood and hardware options. Check out their entire catalog of bespoke products at Atocha Design. That's AtochaDesign.com. They also ship internationally.
The Occasional Podcast.
One more time.
The Occasional Podcast.
Nailed it. This is the Occasional Podcast. My co-host today, Myra.
Hello.
Corporate marketer. Marketer of corporate executive marketer. Individual.
Sure.
Loves the music. She loves music. Music enthusiast to the maximus. She also attends audio shows. Most importantly, she's been to the place where this interview was recorded. And it is not a swear word. It is spelled much differently because today's interview is with Jason Stoddard of Shit Audio, spelled S-C-H-I-I-T. It's supposed to sound that way. It's funnier. And it's the name of his company, so we're going to say it a bunch, and I'm not going to bleep it. So we're just going to keep going with it. Apologies in advance, but he also has a retail establishment up in Northern LA, Los Angeles, Southern California, Northern LA, Newhall, downtown Newhall, where the fires were, unfortunately, pretty close.
Yeah.
An exit or two away from Six Flags. It's a lovely little thing. It used to be a wine house, a wine tasting room. Wine house doesn't make sense. Wine tasting room. And that's where his retail thing is. And that's where we did this interview. And you've been there. What do you think?
The Shitter.
Yeah.
That is the name of the establishment. I really liked it.
What did you think of the Shitter at the Shitter?
The Shitter at the Shitter was top notch, high quality porcelain, very smooth, very comfortable. I enjoyed it. It was very meta. You know, it's a very meta experience to use the bathroom at the Shitter.
It is. Right. So they have a two-channel listening room because they got some new two-channel stuff. And they also have, of course, their bread and butter, tons of headphone amps, DACs, all linked up to individual sources. There's just a long table and a very long list of headphones that you can try out. If you're a headphone enthusiast, this place is your nirvana because they have every headphone there on the wall. It's like a pegboard just filled. Lovely time. And then a ton of amps to try out. He's got tube. He's got solid state. And they have a nice cross-section of all this kind of stuff, and they're known for their budget stuff. It's not super duper high-end in there, although they would definitely say it sounds it, you know? So they have the two-channel room is where we recorded this, so it's a little more soundproof. And it's a fun time up there in Newhall.
Opened just a couple months ago, I think, if I'm not mistaken.
And their manufacturing plant's actually not too far from there as well. So their office is not too far.
Also in Newhall?
I believe so. They got a thing going on in Newhall.
Yeah.
So if you listen to any one track at the Shitter, what would you choose?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think you know that I'm a big fan of yacht rock. So that's usually my go-to is Men with Mullets and Mustaches. That's my jam.
You know, I never really got into you could say it's yacht rock, but I think that a label would be easy listening.
That's basically what it is. I mean, yacht rock is the term you use when you want to sound cool, but it also, yes, it's easy listening music from the 70s sung by men with mullets and mustaches. But when you say yacht rock, it just calls to mind a bigger atmosphere. you can almost taste the salt air as you stand on your yacht with your boat shoes, your Sperry topsiders, and your aviator sunglasses, and your giant handle brush mustache.
Wow. Parliaments? That's so specific. I don't know. The recess filter cigarette? When you see that in your mind, do you think of like one of those cigarette extenders that they have in the movies?
I don't know. I don't know if yacht rockers use cigarette extenders. That's very Cruella de Vil, actually. Mm. I think of like very glamour, fur coat wearing women.
That would be a little bit warm for the boat.
Yeah, yeah. It's more easy breezy when you're listening to yacht rock.
I'm debating T.O.P. You guys let me know. Yeah, T.O.P. The Occasional Podcast. I'm a huge fan. Huge fan of acronyms. Love them.
Yeah. You down with T.O.P.? Yeah, you know me.
It works.
What's up?
You've unlocked it. So now on to the interview. Jason Stoddard of Shit Audio.
Jason Stoddard. This was a good interview.
Yeah.
It was really interesting.
Shit Audio, it's not just a swear word anymore. Ding! I just came up with that. That's so good.
Full of good one-liners today.
Copyrighted. Registered trademark. Sorry, Jason. Sorry, Jason. Jason Stoddard, live from the shitter. It almost sounds like a demented album. Let's do it.
Spin it.
Thanks for joining us. Today we are broadcasting live from the Shitter in New Hall downtown, and our guest is Jason Stoddard of Shit Audio. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. Thanks for joining us. Jason is the head of a company and co-founder of Shit Audio, based out of LA. We're on the outskirts here a little bit. And they've had a wildly popular set of headphone amplifiers. I think initially it was headphone amplifiers. And now they've recently breached the hull into two-channel audio as well with a couple of components. And I just wanted to kind of pick your brain, Jason, about the history of your company and what's been going on with you. So just to kind of kick things off, the name, Shit Audio, it's pretty interesting. Can you enlighten us as to kind of how that name came about?
Before I did Shit, I had an ad agency for 20 years. And, you know, of course, imagine going to a client and saying, hey, you know, you got this new company, you're going to be doing electronics, you really should call it Shit Audio. You know, after you get thrown out of the meeting room, you know, it wouldn't go well. So why did we call ourselves Shit? Well, it's funny. When I was starting this up, again, I had an agency. We were doing this in the garage, we were doing this off hours, and it was eating up all my time. So I was probably working, you know, 16-hour days, you know, between the agency and doing prototyping for Shit. And so when my wife asked me, you know, hey, you want to do this, you want to do that, I was always like, well, no, I got shit to do, I got to work on this shit, I got to do this shit, I got to do this other shit. And finally, she just got totally exasperated, you know, Lisa did, and she goes, why don't you just call the company Shit? And I sat there and went, that's like the stupidest, wait a minute. We don't have a lot of money to start up. You know, we were literally starting in a garage and we didn't have money for advertising. And it's like, no one would forget the name.
Yeah.
And you might be able to play with it a little bit. It sounds maybe a little vaguely Germanic, you know, that, who knows? and so we kind of just started running with it. And ever since, you know, we announced, you know, everyone who has gotten past the name, you know, they're like, wow, this is actually really good Shit, which is, I guess, kind of what we're going for.
Yeah, I mean, and just from what I've seen, too, on Facebook and social media, everybody loves to join in on the fun. I feel like there's that kind of word crafting around there. I feel like there's still ground to be broken, but a lot has been covered, you know.
A lot has been covered. In fact, they were covering more of it today at HeadFi.
So you got the name down, and then what kind of happened next for the company in terms of putting it together? And well, let's dial it back just a little bit.
What did you do before that? Because you do have some more roots in high-end audio than just this company.
Yeah, actually, great question, because I do. I started actually in audio. My degree is in engineering, electronics engineering, which makes it kind of odd that I did an agency. But let's talk about the whole tour and cul-de-sacs and all that stuff. While I was in school, I was getting into audio. I was actually building speakers and started playing around with electronics and doing stuff like that, and said, you know, this is actually really what I want to do. I'd like to work for an audio company. Just out of school, I couldn't work for an audio company. It was in the middle of one of the periodic engineering downturns that we have. Okay. Believe it or not, for everyone who's like younger, there are engineering downturns, and it's hard to get jobs. I came out in the middle of one of those, and it's like, well, I can get a job for Magnavox, which was not audio. It was actually government contracting. They were doing like spread spectrum communication systems. So I took that. But I was always looking for audio, and eventually found a job at a little company called Sumo. Some of you guys may remember that. It was a company started by Jim Bongiorno. It was an offshoot of SAE, an offshoot of Great American Sound, a bunch of the real kind of, you know, foundational audio companies. And Sumo at that time was owned by Caliphone, and I came in and I was kind of brought in to fix some trouble they were having with an amp they had just launched, and also to basically carry the line forward. And so I did a bunch of stuff at Sumo. Sumo, paradoxically, was located right next to another little company called Theta Digital, and it wasn't that little of a company, actually. Everyone kind of knew Mike Moffitt back then in digital. And so we started talking, and Mike kind of said, well, you should design some stuff for us. And, you know, things went back and forth, and eventually I ended up doing, you know, a little bit of work for Theta. Actually, I did the Cobalt 307 DAC and the Gen 5, actually, the output stage.
And you and Mike were working together on those projects?
Yes. Okay. And I was also doing some marketing for both companies, both Sumo and Theta. And, you know, it was funny. The audio was getting into be a weird place at that point. The prices were starting to go crazy, uh-huh. You know, and Mike was kind of going, you know, I don't like this new kind of super high price regime. I don't want to play there. And he was thinking about taking a break and doing some home theater stuff. And I'm like, you know, the agency thing seems kind of fun because I don't have to do prototypes, I don't blow up, and, you know, it seems pretty easy. So after doing that completely idiotic move and starting my own agency and starving for a couple of years, we kind of figured out how to do it. And we had a good, you know, 15 to 20-year run after that. But I always wanted to get back into audio, and I always wanted to do something there. And Mike and I kept in touch over the years, and we're kind of like, well, maybe we could do this, maybe we could do that. And we played with one of the first home theater PCs way back when, called Theatris. Probably no one remembers that. We played with a bunch of things, but we never really did anything. And finally, in 2009, you know, when we're in the middle of another downturn, I'm kind of like, maybe it's time to take a look at audio again. Just talking to Mike and just kind of mentioned, hey, you know, there's a lot of action in this headphone side of things, and I think we could do some good stuff. Would you like to do a DAC for that? And he's like, yeah, you know, get back to me if you do a company, whatever, because he was doing other consulting. Uh-huh. And, so I designed a couple headphone amps, and we launched, and when we started getting orders, I said, hey, Mike, I think we might actually have a company here again.
Yeah, because right around the time you guys launched, that was like, it was almost serendipitous in a way, because that is kind of where things really started to get hot. I feel like right around that time, there weren't that many headphone amps around. I mean, Ray Samuels back in the day did like some IEM stuff, and he had some, and it was just a couple of guys, and all of them definitely dabbled in the higher price points. When you guys got into the market, I feel like it was the right time, the right place, and people were looking to kind of expand at that exact moment.
Yeah, and we focused on the lower price points to start. I mean, it was very disappointing when I wasn't able to do the original Asgard for $199 instead of $249. Back then, that sounds kind of high these days in an era of $99 Magni 3s, but back then it was actually a lower price point, and it was a little shocking.
Yeah. So you guys got the company started. And you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but from my just external kind of vantage point, it feels like the company has had some pretty good success in the past three, 4 years. Would you agree that you guys have been doing well, or how has the, you know, the company either met or exceeded your expectations of where you wanted to be?
If I was going to go completely corporate for a second, I would say it has vastly outperformed my expectations. In fact, we had originally envisioned this as kind of like a hobby business. You know, the agency was doing fine, and it's like, yeah, we'll play around with this, and, you know, heck, you know, maybe we'll even just do like a little add-on in back of the house, and we'll like house the whole thing back there, you know. In between thinking that and like having three people like working full time in our garage and starting to think about, ooh, the HOA eventually is going to get really, really unhappy about this. It's like then, you know, we moved out and grew and grew. And yeah, now we're in about 15,000 square feet and still growing, actually growing more than I expected this year, considering that we didn't have a lot of like really huge intros.
I don't know if anybody really knows everything, but do you think that given your success in such a short time period, do you have a grasp on what your specific appeal is, like what you've done, and what do you think has really kind of garnered that success for you guys?
Actually, I think a lot of it is the name and the brand, and brand not in like, you know, what it looks like or logos or anything like that, but just that, you know, we're kind of forthright. We're one of the first brands that kind of just went out there, especially into the smaller communities, you know, what we call micro social. Like we go to HeadFi, we participate there. You know, we've interacted a lot, and then, you know, I got this crazy idea a few years ago to turn it into a book and serialize it on HeadFi. So a lot of people know what we're doing, and we're very straightforward. A lot of companies like to say, well, you know, if you do this, you know, you're going to hear unicorns and, mm-hmm. you know, and rainbows, and it's going to be wonderful and et cetera. And we're like, well, we don't comment on that, and we don't try to upsell people, and it's a strange approach. Some people really like it, and some people don't get it at all.
Transparency in a kind of a foggy atmosphere, I guess you could say, with high end.
It's actually, I don't know if high end is so foggy. It's just, it's so traditional. In some ways, it's so traditional old sales. You know, well, yeah. if you start here, this is good, but this is better, and this is best. And of course, you know, best is always the highest price, and best has like additional add ons that make it even better, bester, and that's even more money. And it's like, we're kind of like, well, no, actually, you could probably just get a Magni 3 and you're done.
I remember,
you know, if you want to buy more expensive stuff, we make a lot more expensive stuff.
So. I remember when we were at the launch of one of your products and I had asked you, I'm like, well, hey Jason, I'm looking at this product you just launched and it's kind of overlapping with another product you have. And I was like, is this going to cannibalize? And you're like, well, we're just going to have to see what happens. Like it's not this tiered upsell feature set, boom, 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 where it's a push up the ladder constantly with you guys. It seems like you guys have more expensive stuff, but it's not force fed really.
And it's a little good and bad because people do get confused by our line. Mm. You know, the line's big enough now. A lot of people are like, so what the heck do I need?
Yeah.
Depending on their headphones, sometimes we can recommend something great. And sometimes it's like, well, pretty much everything works. You know, do you want to deal with tubes? You know, do you want the certainty of solid state? You know, we try to narrow it down like that. But, you know, we do a wide range of stuff. And a lot of my focus now is like when we introduce something, like, does it make sense? Does it cause additional confusion? Does it overlap? You know, should we be, you know, making products go away? Like we collapse the Magni line from a Magni 2 and a Magni 2 Uber to just a Magni 3 and it's done. I'd love to do that with Modi. Guys, don't get too excited because that's like way out in the future if that happens, because getting like a $99 Modi 2 Uber is not as simple as the Magni, to put it mildly.
So given your budget kind of aspirations, what is the cheapest product you think you might ever produce? I mean, is $99...
I think it's about there. I mean, if it's made entirely in the U.S., like we're doing, then that's pretty much it. If you make it overseas, well, yeah, you might be able to make it, you know, make something cheaper, but that's not really us. So, you know, we're never going to be the cheapest. We're never going to be the most expensive. But we'll probably skew on the lower end of things.
So you've released some definitely flagship, you know, what I think a lot of people consider audiophile price point DACs and your ladder DACs and that. Do you feel like, inversely, come to the budget side, how high do you think that you might go someday?
I think that we're at that. I think Iggy, Yggdrasil, and Ragnarok are probably the most expensive products we want to do. Honestly, I'd like to do everything at three figures or under, but you know that's not realistic for some of the products.
So I have to ask, recently you guys kind of had a little bit of a ribbing, I think, a kind of a fun joke you did with Stereophile. Do you care to elaborate on that at all?
Oh, Stereophile. Yeah, that was great. I mean, they actually gave us a wonderful idea for new ads because, you know, we haven't really had a concerted ad campaign. We kind of started last year, you know, advertising regularly in Stereophile and Absolute Sound, and we've had some ads online for a while, but you know, there hasn't really been a theme. And so we got this review of Yggdrasil and Stereophile, and it was good. It was a great review. They liked it, but their editor, you know, Stereophile's editor, John Atkinson, said, "Hey, you know, this DAC is, you know, Herb liked it, even though it was obsolete." I'm paraphrasing, but he put that on Facebook, and I saw that, and I said, wait a minute, obsolete in engineering terms means not recommended for new designs. The stuff we're using is clearly not NRND, you know, and I kind of said, yeah, why is this? And he's like, well, it's only 20-bit DACs. I'm like, well, you know, there's really not more than 20 bits of resolution in anything, so it was a semantic thing, but it irked me a little bit that he chose to use that word. And I was like, you know, what a lot of companies might do is, I'm going to pull my advertising from Stereophile. It's like, no, actually, that's a great headline. You know, a picture of our DAC with the big headline, obsolete. You know, not attributed to John. This is just, we're just having a little fun. Because I realized, you know, yeah, it's obsolete, just like tubes. Yeah. Just like discrete design, just like low price components, just like class A stuff. You know, I mean, all that stuff could be called obsolete. So it's like, okay, cool. We're the obsolete guys. And we've been kind of running, you know, under a banner of obsolete and other various adjectives like that since then. And so I look at it as we're having a little fun with Stereophile. Hopefully Stereophile sees it the same way. They're taking the ads, but...
Yeah, I'd like to point out... Like to point out, you guys ran those ads in Stereophile.
Yes, I did. Yeah, and that we did that like really the same day, actually, because I was contacted by the Stereophile's ad rep right on the day that Stereophile posted on Facebook, and I'm like, you know, that was like, oh god, you know, I just confirmed our ad, and then I contacted him. I said, can I change the ad? He's like, oh yeah, no problem. So I uploaded new artwork, and that's kind of the way it's been going.
So having kind of a nice base going in the personal audio space, what's kind of triggered your notion to get back into the two-channel, the loudspeaker space with these new products you've kind of come out recently with?
God, if I was to be frank, it's like because we're complete idiots. We just have kind of a very long history in two-channel. And so Mike and I experiment with a lot of things, and a lot of things don't turn into products, but... In this case, we started playing around with preamps and power amps about 2 years ago now. And, you know, Mike's kind of like, wait, do we really want to do power amps? You know, power amps, you know, that's the stuff that really kind of, it blows up and catches on fire. You know, if bad things happen in a system, it's usually a large power amp. I said, yeah, but, you know, we're getting better at managing, you know, doing the protection system and stuff like that. It's probably okay. And he was a little skeptical, but kind of went along with it. And the preamps, he was kind of, you know, in with from the start. And he's like, but they have to have 6SN7 tubes. And I'm like, Mike, you know, we've always used 6DGA8, you know, style tubes, which are a smaller tube. He's like, no, it's got to have 6SN7s because those sound like way better. And I'm like, you realize that everyone who's like bought a bunch of tubes for our products and probably has the list, which are our solid state tubes, are going to be really irritated. He's like, yeah, but they sound a lot better. Just build a prototype. So I did. And I'm like, oh, wow, this actually does sound a heck of a lot better. And the preamps we kind of fell into because of that, and also because I must say, because we were prompted to do it by many people on HeadFi. There were a lot of people who kind of said, after we introduced Ragnarok, they said, you got an interesting suite of technologies there. You know, you have a microprocessor-controlled amp, and you have this relay switched attenuator preamp. You know, why don't you break them apart? You know, there's really nothing going on the relay stepped attenuator, you know, preamp side of things. And I looked around and I'm like, wow, yeah, you're right. And after going to an audio show where someone showed me a microprocessor based non-relay switching, but just like, you know, conventional, you know, volume pot type preamp, and said it's quite a bargain at $20,000. I was like, okay, it's time to do some preamps, because there ain't no way these things should cost that kind of money.
Yeah,
and that's kind of how we ended up getting the preamps. The preamps are, they're very, very high value. They're shockingly high value in the space, but they don't have some features that people want. They don't have home theater bypass and, you know, things like that. So if you want a pure like old school preamp, they're great. You know, will we do a new school one? Who knows? You know, right now it's like that. Those are so far out, it's not even worth discussing.
You get back into home theater?
Never. Yeah, and actually, I can speak for Mike on that one. It's not just no, but hell no. When he's polite, he'll say, yeah, when Shrimps learn to whistle is when he's going to get back into home theater. If he's not feeling polite, he's a lot more direct, because he actually started a company doing the first upgradable home theater processor, a company called Angstrom. Some people may remember that. That was actually one of the most difficult companies that Mike had, because he was dealing with all the standards bodies.
Oh, yes.
And standards kept changing, and it was very hard for a small company to react. And yeah, he had some life stuff at the time, and yeah, it was not pretty. And you know, anytime you mention Dolby, DTS, Auro, or any other surround standards to Mike, he'll just shudder and walk away. Right. So no home theater. You know, you could use Vidar in home theater. I'll be using Vidar in my home theater. I just haven't got around to, you know, stacking up a bunch of them yet for that. But it, you know, it's a two-channel amp. You can use 3.5 of them or 7 of them, or, you know, I don't know how many channels home theaters are up to these days, but, you know. Just keep adding, I guess.
I guess that kind of leads into another kind of conversation piece that I've heard you guys talk about, and that is MQA.
Mm-hmm.
So MQA is not unlike, I guess you could say, some of the Dolby Digital things from home theater, in that it has to be decoded at the source. And you guys have been a little more outspoken than most on that particular subject. What are your feelings on MQA and that kind of thing? And for the same thing, DSD too, but not quite as...
Yeah, those are both relevant, because we don't support either. And our feelings on MQA haven't changed since our press release we did about a year and a half ago now. We still feel exactly the same way about it. And the reason we did that press release is we were starting to get inquiries, and we wanted to actually tell our customers and customer base that, like, if you ever expect to get MQA, you know, because there's always the promise in an upgradable system that it'll show up. If you ever want to get MQA, you best to get out of shit now. Because, you know, we are not going to support it. We do not feel that it, you know, brings any benefit to the listener, and in fact, we think it's really kind of not worth discussing very much, because it's only on title, and I don't know. Mike has probably more pointed words, but I'm like, no one asks about it anymore. No one seems to be all that interested. Our DAC sales keep going up, so I don't really care what MQA does. I know that they have it on phones now, so it's like, great. It's like SRS. You know, it's another technology that no one actually wanted, but appeared everywhere. And, you know, some people try to use it as a selling point, but it's not. So okay, let's move on and let's get back to real high end, which is, you know, uncompressed and FLAC and stuff like that, and let's continue that.
But correct me if I'm wrong, but from a manufacturer's standpoint, if you were in its current state, if you were to implement MQA into one of your DACs, you would have to pay a licensing fee for that.
We haven't actually explored it that much. Okay. We understand that, yes, that is the case. It'd probably be best to ask a manufacturer
who does.
I mean, the MQA patent makes some very interesting reading because it does have, you know, some very kind of, to us, scary DRM, you know, provisions in it, you know, including selective degradation and device shutdown and stuff like that. So, you know, if we signed on to MQA, we're kind of implicitly saying, hey, we're okay with passing that along to our customers in the future. Maybe if they enable it, we don't know if they will. We don't know what the future will be. So we're just, our thing is like, hey, you know, we've always been about PCM. We're going to do PCM real well. And, you know, if you got PCM sources, we're great. And that's also why we don't do DSD. DSD is, there's nothing wrong with it as a format. It's just, it's very niche. If you have a bunch of DSD, if you have a bunch of SACD that's been turned into, you know, DSD rips, then, yeah, unless you want to convert it all to PCM, you know, on the fly, it's, you know, shit DAC is probably not going to be your first choice. And that's cool. There's room for everyone. I mean, there's room for people selling MQA. There's room for people selling DSD. You know, there's room for PCM is still, you know, 99.9% of the market. There's plenty of room for PCM.
Yeah, I always thought the funny thing about DSD is that no one really has it, but so many people like to see it on that feature set just because of the exclusivity of it. Like, for those who don't know, it's like DSD is not generally widely available for songs that everybody loves. You have to essentially break a few laws to get it in the first place.
And I think that's probably what kind of set us off on MQA to start was, we're like, oh, we've seen this playbook before. It's Dolby, it's DTS. You know, it's like you have to have the right logos on your product all the time. It's HDMI, you know, it's the same kind of thing, you know, where you actually have to have all that or people won't buy it. Except right now in home theater, it's kind of funny. I know a lot of people are kind of stepping off the chain now. They're like, you know, 4K is fine, but I don't really need it. And I don't, you know, why do I really want to do this? I don't want to pull new HDMI through the walls. I don't want to deal with this. Let's just wait a bit. You don't know how long the merry-go-round can go. And like, we didn't want to, like, you know, get onto the, like, how many stickers can we stick on the front of our product, you know, brigade. It might be an important thing to add for some people, but, you know, not for us.
Yeah, I was just thinking too about how when HD came out, this is kind of like the DSD thing. People were saying, "Oh, it's better, but most people probably won't be able to tell." And then it was like 720, and then they said the same thing when it was 1080, and now we're sitting at 4K. We're like three steps of resolution removed from when people originally started saying, "Eh, most people won't use this."
Yeah, and they're talking 8K now. And the thing is, screens are getting bigger. So, you know, I've had a home theater for a long time. You know, full disclosure, I've had a home theater for a long time. I've been involved in home theater for a long time. I have a real, you know, projector system. I have a real surround processor from Emotiva. I use their XMC1. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's a great processor for what it's worth. You know, I'm not dissing Emotiva. Just, you know, if anyone's like, oh, well, I really prefer so-and-so, it's like, fine, that's good too. I'd like Emotiva, you know, it's what I use. Yeah. I use Emotiva amps in the home theater for the moment. Eventually I'll move to ours, but, you know, it is what it is. But
so honest.
I'm just saying, you know, I've had a home theater for a long time. And when you're looking at a 120-inch projector screen, oh, yeah, the difference between SD and HD is immediate. The difference between HD and 4K I have not actually experienced yet because I haven't got a 4K projector because they've just started coming down in price. 4K on, like, a 70 or 80-inch direct view is probably going to be better than, you know, on a 70 or 80, you know, than HD on a 70 or 80-inch. On 40 to 50, it's like, oh, you know, really?
40.
Yeah.
40. Oof.
Yeah. Yeah, so... yeah, it's all horses for courses. And like, if you're talking 4K and 8K, so hey, where's all your content? Where's your content coming from? Please tell me. Oh, are you getting it from Netflix? Oh, so you have a 25 megabit per second stable connection. You can really do that.
Right.
And it never actually, you know, downshifts into HD. Yeah, uh-huh, that's nice. Yeah. So, yeah. Anyway.
So, yeah, Apple's kind of gotten on board at least a little bit more. We're looking at their but you have to buy the new little... They're going to, like, give out 4K at the same price as HD.
Good.
But the last I checked, it was about... It's not many movies. I'm not going to try to get the exact number, but it's the same thing. And that goes right along with kind of how the DSD and the... And not MQA. I mean, there's a good chunk of MQA on title.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's just one of those things where it's just not... There's no one thing in the chain that will magically make everything perfect, I think. You know, when it's in terms of music, there's a lot of weight, I believe, put on the original production.
Mm-hmm.
How good is the original production done? And what happens after that? Every step is important. But there isn't one single step after the record leaves the studio that will magically fix anything or is like, everything can make it worse, I think.
Yeah.
But not everything can make it 100% better either.
And I agree with you 100%. It's like, it's really the master. You know, it's the master. It's the original. Work on that. You know, work on the loudness wars. Work on that stuff. And then, you know, believe me, we'll sort this out on the reproduction side. It drives a lot of people insane when we actually don't have an opinion on how things sound. But I like to use this analogy because I had this discussion online recently where someone's saying, well, but you know, should I get a Jotunheim or should I get a Ragnarok or should I, you know, can I do a Magni 3 or should I go tubes or should, yeah, it's, you know, those are valid questions. And our question is usually like, what headphones do you have? And, you know, the guy's like, well, I have like Sennheiser HD 598s. It's like, you probably don't need an amp. Go buy a better transducer if you want to upgrade. And he actually took great exception to that. He's like, well, but, you know, there's a lot of people, it's like, you know, start with electronics first. And I said, okay. So in informal listening tests, you know, I'm not going to get into, you know, blind ABs and stuff. In informal listening tests, I think I can say reasonably confidently there are a number of people who can tell the difference between amps. There are some different people that can tell the difference between DACs. For some of those people, those differences matter. For some of those people, they don't. And some people can't hear it at all. But nobody has ever said, I can't tell the difference between a Grado and an Odyssey. Period. You know, or you are deaf. And, you know, in that case, great. You don't have to spend any money on this at all. You know, but the thing is, start with a transducer. Get a great transducer that you like. And then you can flavor it a bit, you know, with what we do. And this is all up on our site. It's under, you know, our principles, you know, and we refer to it all the time. And that's one of our things. Like I mentioned, you know, we don't do the hard sell. We actually don't have sales. There's nobody at Shit with the title of sales or the function of sales. There's no sales. Everyone just kind of comes and buys. Or comes and asks questions and buys, or comes and goes away. And that's about it.
Do you have, I know this is a little bit granular, but do you, in your mind at least, have a kind of a budget alignment that you recommend people, given the price of your amps? Do you say, if you have, and this is a pretty simple equation, how much percent on the transducer, how much on the amp, how much on the source? Let's just stick with those three for now.
Actually, great question. And we don't have an actual, you know, hard number. But I will always say, spend the most on the transducer. You know, spend the most on what is actually making the sound. You know, if I was, you know, doing a $3,000, you know, pair of headphones, I don't think I'd want a $30,000 amp to go with it. I might want a $300 amp, a $1,000 amp, or maybe, you know, if it's fantastic, a $3,000 amp. But I couldn't see myself spending more money on the front end than the transducer.
Yeah, I agree. I think always in the case of two channel, the most on the on the speakers, and then amp and source and these kind of things are a bit tertiary. And I, and if you have the budget, if it's getting, you know, if the whole thing's getting up there, I do think that, you know, cabling is something that you should look at once you're to that point with the other components. Do you have any kind of opinion on the cable argument? Because a lot of audiophiles love to discuss things to death. It's, that's definitely one of the points. Do you lean one way or the other?
Yeah, I'm more of a cable agnostic. I mean, I actually have heard cable differences with a highly sensitive transducer. Actually, you know, very specifically, Sennheiser HD800s.
Okay.
And different kinds of cables. I've actually heard some differences that have correlated with what other people have said, you know, unprompted. So maybe they exist, maybe they don't. But to me, I've never seen like a night or day difference, you know, attaching a cable to a system and go, oh my God, it's totally different. Whereas if you go from, say, a, you know, very, you know, a very low power amp, you know, if you go from something that's 10 to 50 watts, and not really designed to drive really reactive loads, and you got something that's, you know, like mono Vidar's 400 watts, something like that, that's going to be actually a fairly significant difference. You know, you'll probably, you know, you'll probably hear and enjoy that. You're not going to get, to me, and the cable guys are going to kill me now, to me, you're not going to see that level of change with cables, but you know, that's why the transducer guys love it. The speaker and headphone guys love us because we're saying, hey, spend all the money there. And the cable guys hate us because we're kind of like, well, you know, if you got extra money left over, and actually, in the case of headphones, if the cable's too long, hello, Sennheiser, or if it is like really microphonic, you know, hello, lots of people. Yeah, the aftermarket cables make total sense.
Oh man, the original 650 cable. Do you remember that thing?
Yeah, they're still 10 feet long.
So
yeah,
big.
Yeah, they're still 10 feet long. I'm like, really? So, oh no, the funniest thing is the new Sennheiser, the HD660S. It comes with an 1/8 inch plug and then an adapter rather than the 1/4 inch plug.
Yeah.
So 1/8 inch, they're like saying, oh yeah, you know, it's probably best for mobile. The cable's still 10 feet long. It's like, guys, have you ever used this, like, like on a bus or seriously?
You have to tuck it. Is that a cable in your pocket, sir? Yeah. Or are you
exactly? So yeah, and it's funny. We actually have a lot of aftermarket cables, either to do balanced or, you know, to make it shorter, or, you know, we were breaking too many Sennheiser headphones at shows because people would trip on the cables. So we bought a bunch of 5-foot, you know, like balanced connector, you know, balanced cables, and problem solved.
I think I saw at one show, and I thought this was almost you guys just playing a little joke, but there you had like the very, very inexpensive, I forget the site right now, but they're like notorious for making the very inexpensive cables, and you had it, and I was like, oh, that's such a shit thing to do.
Oh yeah, actually we have, I don't
they're
know
like
about
red and black and
monoprice.
That's
we yeah. we have used monoprice, and we have used, I think right now we're using mainly blue jeans.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Throughout, and that seems to be a good step up. You know, in quality. We also use, you know, straight wire and stuff like that. Yeah. It's straight wire makes our little short cables. You know, it's cunningly, you know, they're cunningly disguised, you know, because they screen straight wire on every, you know, piece of cable they sell to us. But
and just so you guys know, on from my experience as well, I've heard differences in some cables occasionally, but I agree with Jason in that it's, you know, drivers first, then amps, and then if you get to this point where you have everything kind of laid in, a little bit more durable cable. I will say the monoprices, they do okay, but
yeah,
the connector
not,
tips,
not great.
They broke. Like from a construction standpoint, some of the higher end stuff just will last you longer. And it's fun to play with.
I really can't like truthfully recommend monoprice, except they're the small, like the 1/8 inch to the dual RCAs. Mm. They have like a slim one. That one's actually not a bad cable, you know, if you're going, say, like from a full of two to, you know, to another source, something like that. But a lot of their stuff, yeah, I think I would step up and buy something a little better. Monoprice is the only cable that has ever actually physically pulled an RCA jack shell out of our chassis. So there you go.
Wow.
Yeah.
I just want to thank Jason for jumping on the show with us. If you'd like to check out more of Shit Audio's products, the website is www.schiit.com, and they ship direct. Do you guys have a dealer network? Or
We don't have a dealer network. We have a worldwide distribution network. They usually work more like we do, in that you'd probably be buying direct from the distributor rather than through their dealer network. And then we also have what we call the Shitter, which is our, we have a little captive retail store in downtown Newhall. So if you are in the LA area, and you're, you know, if you got a car or you're near the metro rail, you can come up and, you know, actually hang out with some people and try pretty much everything, including we have the turntable prototype here right now, the upcoming turntable Soul. As yet unpriced, but you know, it's here for people to play with, and everyone seems to have been enjoying it so far.
And they have separate rooms. One is for listening to pretty much every single rig you have in terms of headphones, with a nice wall of headphones. There's got to be at least 12, 18 pairs in there.
Yeah, and we're going to add a couple more. I know that we're kind of, we need some of the newer Sennheiser, the newer Mr. Speakers. We're adding some of the newer Odysseys as well. So, but right now we have a good selection of pretty much everything.
And then in their loudspeaker room, they have their two-channel stuff set up and some more of their high-end DAC components. But also, I believe they're rolling with the LS50 from Kef.
Yep.
And then a Salk. What model Salk?
The Salk Song 3s.
Song 3s.
Which is... We like to exhibit with Salk. Their stuff seems to sound really good with ours. And the Song 3 was the first speaker we exhibited with. One of our tech support guys bought the pair that we exhibited with. Then we bought another pair here. Mike actually asked him for a modified pair and got that. And now the Song 3As are like what Mike asked for. And I understand that's their best-selling speaker right now. So, yeah, it's funny. They're a neat company, completely different from us, where we say we do it kind of one way and that's the way it is. They're like, how do you want it? What color, do you want? You want these options? That they will fully customize everything, and it's kind of cool for speakers, for something that's furniture and large. Yeah. Kind of makes a lot of sense.
Do you have a favorite pair of headphones?
I go back and forth. Actually, the Mr. Speakers Etherflow Opens are always near the top, as are the HD800S's, as are the Odyssey. I haven't made it up to the LCD4s, but the 2s, the 3s, and some of the new, one of the newer ones I heard, I think the MX4, was pretty neat. But those companies, they seem to have the same problem we do. Their lines are getting big, so it's heck, I don't know.
Well, I appreciate all your time. Thank you so much.
Cool. Thank you.